Arm's Length Reporting for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. Time for KER Politics. You know, we're living in very turbulent times right now, very uncertain times right now. We have an awful lot of nervousness out there, almost to the point of paranoia on the part of some people. We have a number of states that are using this as an excuse to circumvent Second Amendment rights, which I think is a terrible mistake. You know my opinion on that. When guns are outlawed, truly only outlaws will have the guns. We have an expert as our first guest on this particular subject. His name is Alan Gottlieb. Alan is from Bellevue, Washington. He is a nuclear physicist and an extremely effective defender of Second Amendment rights. Got some interesting things to say to you guys. You know, on this particular program, we are trying to be nothing but positive. We don't bring a lot of negativity to people's minds right now. This one may seem like a bit of negativity, but it really isn't. It's being aware of the facts. I have a gentleman on the line with me right now. Alan is involved with the firearms industry. He has some very, very interesting comments about those folks who are trying to, I'm going to use the word shut down the firearms industry. I think that tells it like it is. Mr. Gottlieb, you're on, sir.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate being with you.
Okay, now what exactly, you started out with talking about New Jersey. Now the fact that some lawmakers are attempting to make firearms illegal right now is slowly, and I have to say slowly, starting to spread. Any comments, Alan?
Yeah, the Second Amendment Foundation, of which I'm the executive vice president, has filed suit against the state of New Jersey, where the governor, by executive order, closed down gun shops under the guise that they're not essential businesses. Mm-hmm. He went further than that. He also shut down the state patrol to do background checks. And in New Jersey, the only way a person can transfer a firearm is through a licensed dealer after going through the state patrol's background check system. So the system is shut down. Gun stores are shut down. Nobody can buy guns or ammunition in the whole state of New Jersey. And we filed a challenge to that, denying people their constitutional rights under the color of law in federal court in New Jersey. Now, we did that real quickly, and I'm hoping real quickly the court's going to hear the case in an expedited manner. We also have situations around the country where, other orders in Connecticut, in Illinois, where you have anti-gun governors, have actually said that gun stores are essential businesses because people need the means to be able to purchase self-protection. But we have some problems like in Pennsylvania, where initially the governor said no. You shut down all gun stores as well, just like New Jersey, but now he's backtracked because of a lawsuit we have there. Likewise, we have a situation in Washington State where the governor's done the same thing and said gun stores have to shut down, and we are in process of filing suit against Washington right now. Likewise, against the state of Vermont, likewise against the county in North Carolina, and cities in California like San Diego and San Jose. So it is spreading, like you said.
You know, Alan, I have to tell you a personal opinion. Living in Washington State, as I have basically all of my life, I'm not surprised that action is being successful on our side of the mountains, which is the west side. I mean, King County, Snohomish County, etc., incredibly, incredibly liberal. I'm surprised, though, that this is taking hold slightly, and I'd like your comment on that. On this, over in Eastern Washington, Eastern Washington is definitely red, for the most part, aside from Patty Murray.
Yeah, well, the governor's order again is for the whole state, so it affects Eastern Washington as well. As a result, by the way, we have a significant number of county sheriffs in Washington State that are in the process of signing a letter to go to the governor, telling him that he's wrong, and for them, for lots of reasons, gun stores are essential businesses. So even the police buy their ammunition, and buy firearms from local police departments. I mean, from local gun stores. So there's a pushback coming, and I think we'll win on that. And the other side, they're trying to, it's a way of demonizing guns and gun ownership. We had the sheriff in Los Angeles County say, hey, I'm a gun owner, I support the Second Amendment, but there are too many people right now, new people going and buying guns, and that's going to result in all kinds of accidents, and so we have to shut down gun stores. I mean, again, in times of national emergencies, when people tend to go out and buy guns and ammunition, and, you know, that's when you may need them for self-protection, and you know, and this is when these people are trying to shut down our rights.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm very interested in this particular subject, but I have to say that, in my opinion, I would hope that anybody who goes out and purchases either a sidearm or a rifle really would know how to use it, or at least make damn sure that whoever they purchase that item from at least gives them some basic instruction. Very, very easy to put that together up here where I live in the northern part of the state. We have a very active sportsman's club. They have a very good program, very efficient, not incredibly time-consuming, illustrating to people the importance of taking firearms seriously and knowing how to use them. Comments?
Well, I don't disagree with you at all. I think if you have a firearm, you should have some training, know how to use it so it's effective for you, you know, to save your life and the lives of others as well. And most gun owners do that. I mean, I don't know very many people that go out and buy a gun and then don't do any training or, right, you know, or know how to use it. And it's not that difficult to learn how to use a firearm, let's be honest about it. It has a lot less moving parts on it than an automobile.
That's right. I'm glad you brought that up, Alan. It really is a matter of common sense and amassing the necessary knowledge. How is your organization fairly successful right now in its endeavors regarding the Second Amendment?
Well, let me put it this way.
Yeah.
80% of the case law, I mean, a full 80% of the case law that have been won in the courts defending Second Amendment rights has been won by the Second Amendment Foundation and or our attorneys. Mm-hmm. And that case law now is being used by anybody else who goes to court to protect gun rights. You know, the McDonald decision, the Heller decision in the U.S. Supreme Court, and a significant other ones in the appeals court level across the country is what the foundation is now in the legal system to protect gun rights. And it's been 80% won by the Second Amendment Foundation. You can go online at saf.org, samalphafrank.org, and a list of the cases and the work we've done is there. And it's really quite impressive and quite amazing, and we do it with a very small budget.
Yeah. I want to leave you with one thought, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to ask the following question for comment from Mr. Gottlieb, and that is, you go back to the old argument that when guns are outlawed, only outlaws will own the guns. That sounds simplistic. It sounds almost humorous. But I have to tell you, growing up in the big city of Seattle, Washington, I know that that's true. A lot of violence down there, and that violence is occurring not by the legal gun owners, but by gang members, etc., etc. Could you close us out, Mr. Gottlieb, on that thought? Your opinion, please.
Well, I agree with you. That's why gun control laws don't work, because criminals are called criminals because they break laws. And so whatever law you pass, if they're a criminal, they're going to break it anyway. Or does it make it harder for law-abiding people to be able to get a firearm to protect themselves and their families from criminal attack? So you're right.
Yeah, 100%. And all I can say to folks out there is I want you to take Alan Gottlieb's advice, and that is if you decide to purchase a weapon, make sure you know how to use it, and make sure you don't give it away to somebody who you don't know. Make sure you don't put yourself in a position where somebody can steal it from you. Alan Gottlieb, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
You stay safe where you are, sir. As an addendum here, just a couple of comments more from me. Number one, I really respect people like Alan Gottlieb. He is doing a very, very effective job defending the Constitution and, I have to say, protecting our rights. Gun control is a very interesting situation, and it only boils down to one simple thing. It's a term that you're going to hear us use numerous times this hour, and that term is common sense.
your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, here is promised with my buddy Jeff Deist. Jeff is the president of the Mises Institute, one of the sharpest economies and one of the sharpest economic think tanks that I would have to say that I'm aware of. Jeff, the bill just passed on Friday, yesterday, and we're recording on Friday. What do you think about the stimulus bill?
Wow, what a can of worms. I mean, first of all, we're talking about $2 trillion that Congress doesn't have to spend.
Of course not.
Let's get that first and foremost. This money is going to come out of all of our future work. This is a claim on the future. There's no government doesn't have money. It doesn't own anything. Whatever it gets from us. So that's a good starting point. But what's in it? Okay. Well, quite a lot, as you would imagine. And between, first of all, crafting this bill in a rush, as they always do with these emergency type bills. Second of all, crafting it over a weekend when a lot of members of Congress have been at home quarantined. And by home, I mean in their districts, not in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, passing it on the Senate side at something like 1 in the morning on Saturday, early Sunday morning. All of this is a recipe for lots and lots of mischief.
Mm-hmm.
And that mischief takes the form of lobbyists getting things into these bills that it's almost impossible for average people to know. Because if you look at this bill, which is several hundred pages, you can turn to, open a page and turn to it, and it'll say section 38A little i3 of 21 U.S. Code section 9505 is hereby amended to insert may instead of shall, this sort of thing. And you'd have to go down the rabbit hole of the bill or that they're referencing to even have a sense of what's happening. But the staff who work on these bills, not the members of Congress and not the senators themselves, the staff, okay, in conjunction with lobbyists, they know what these little sections mean. And there's just a lot of money in there that has nothing to do with the coronavirus, has nothing to do with the financial crisis we're facing. It's just money people wanted for things like the Kennedy Center, for Amtrak. There's over $1 billion for Amtrak in this bill. So that's the kind of thing that's just par for the course when you have late night rushed large spending bills. But more importantly, it's the kind of thing that's par for the course when we've just untethered money from work. The idea that government can just create money and credit, or the central bank can just create money and credit out of thin air, is now something that's really entrenched in our society. And it began after 9/11. It really began in the 1970s, but it began, it intensified after 9/11. It was obviously a big part of what happened in 08 around the financial crisis of that time. And now we're doing it on steroids. And the $2 trillion that the House and Senate are doing, that's just the fiscal side. On the monetary side, the Fed is talking about another $2 trillion at least in terms of liquidity available to markets. Already, its balance sheet is up over $5 billion. Although it got well below 4 when they first started quantitative easing a few years ago. So I suspect the Fed's balance sheet will get to $10 trillion, $10 trillion with a T, over the next few years.
Make it a capital T.
Yeah. And so we have to just ask ourselves, does any of this actually create any real goods or services in the economy? Does any of it make us more productive or wealthier? And I think the answer is no. I think it creates a very false sense of, we're resuscitating the patient. And it's very frightening to me, because the scary thing that could happen is hyperinflation.
Yep.
Is rapid price increases. So to me, there are lots of other things Congress could be doing and the Fed could be doing to help with this coronavirus. This ain't it.
Jeff, let me ask you a question. You gave a couple of examples that I think are absolutely amazing that things like that would get into a bill. When we have an economic emergency with a capital E that we have right now, I think you can't really worry about the Kennedy Center. You have to kind of put Amtrak on the back burner. Something else that I would like to say that I think Schumer tried to pop into this thing that the Republicans, if I'm not mistaken, wheedled out real quick, and that was more money for, pro-choice, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, Jeff, we have to forget about politics, if that's possible. We have to forget about getting votes. We have to put together a bill that will allow America to survive. I'm not sure that's what's happening.
Sure, we've politicized an infectious disease crisis. Mm-hmm. That's what we've done. And that was going to happen in a country as divided as ours is. And what's happening right now is akin to, let's say, a family.
Yep.
A family that was deeply in debt and whose debt service was wildly outsized relative to their income. And all of a sudden, something that wasn't their fault, let's just say, came along like a terrible storm and tore the roof off their house. Okay,
right.
Well, you got to have a roof on your house, and that costs $25,000 to fix. So they go out and they say, even though we don't have the money, we're going to use our credit card. Mm-hmm. And spend $25,000, and God knows what interest we're going to pay in the future. God knows what we're doing to our kids, but we're going to put it on the credit card because we have to have a roof on our house. But at the same time, let's go also spend $5,000 on a trip to Disney World with the kids.
Yeah,
because we've already wanted to do that. What the hell? We're spending $25 anyway. I mean, that's the analogy here.
That's right. It's a great analogy. Another analogy that I think is a little bit more accurate, really, I mean, that's very accurate for our society, but given the I want it now, instant gratification philosophy that we have, I look at this as kind of being, not only is it a roof on the house, but perhaps it's a new BMW in the garage, which is not a necessity, Jeff. You and I are both Beamer fans, but we know they are not necessities. Necessities have to be in the picture and not discretionary, wildly discretionary spending, right?
Yeah, this is what politics does, though, is it creates a short-term mentality. It creates a high time preference. We want stuff now, and we want to kick the can down the road, push the problems off into the future. And honestly, when politicians do that, we get pissed off, but we still reelect them.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons that I'm a card-carrying libertarian, I have to say. Go ahead, Jeff. Sorry, you got about 10 seconds there. We got to take a commercial break. You're on, bud.
Well, again, this is what democracy does. It makes us spend today at the expense of tomorrow.
Yep. Well, I have to tell you, I want to get back on this in the second segment. We're going to take a real quick commercial break here, folks, for the top of the hour news on the stations that carry our show. We appreciate their including us in their programming. I'm going to be right back with my buddy Jeff Dice.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Continuing my discussion with Jeff Deist right now. I want to wrap up this discussion, Jeff, where you give your opinion, stating facts really more than anything else, on the bill that just passed yesterday. It was probably rather essential, but certainly not essential in the form that it passed. Comment?
A lot of people are suffering. I get that. Could we just allow people to go back to work and allow the bankruptcies and rental defaults and mortgage defaults and commercial defaults and credit card defaults and all that to just happen and wend its way through this traditional normal legal process? I guess we could. We've lost our appetite for that. That's the kind of thing that happened in the Great Depression.
Yep.
Nobody looked to the government to bail them out, and nobody thought that they would get relief from mortgage payments or anything else. Obviously, we're in a different time now, and as we said during the earlier segment, we now have this expectation that money comes from government, mm-hmm. and that it's untethered from our own actions, our own work, and I think this is very dangerous. I really don't like the precedent of telling millions of Americans to sit at home for a few weeks and we'll send you a check, because look, this is something that the left wants anywhere.
Yeah.
Forget the crisis. There are millions of people in this country who think that wealth just exists, it just materializes, and all we need to do is sort of divvy it up more fairly, and that politics and economics just stand in the way of it. There's a lot of people who think that and think that people should just be allowed to sort of sit at home and get rent and food and at least a decent subsistence living so that they can work on their art or their creative hobbies or whatever it might be, and that that we have reached a level of abundance where scarcity doesn't really matter, and that we ought to be angling towards an end to work. There are plenty of people in America who think this. This is not some bizarre fringe of the progressive movement. There are lots and lots of progressives who think that we shouldn't work. And I don't know how to respond to that. I don't think we're anywhere close to the singularity or post scarcity in the West. I think that the material abundance that's all around us will respond very quickly and fall away very quickly to the wrong incentives. And it just worries me a lot, the mindset that we're creating.
Jeff, I got a question for you. Great Depression was one thing. What we have right now is, and I, as you know, I've had too many conversations, man, about, you know what my politics are. But I have to say this. I think the one thing that makes this situation a little bit unique right now is the disease. This disease potentially is a killer, and that's my understanding, okay? I'm not a doctor, I'm not a medical person, but this disease is a killer as of this moment in time. If it was a proven fact that this thing was just a different case of the flu where people got sick, and never mind the fatality rate, because the fatality rate, as you know, just for the normal seasonal flu is not zero, not even close. It's my impression the fatality rate on this thing is a little bit higher, and that was like a lot higher. And the reason I'm coming to the conclusion that I come to, and I really want to hear your response to this, is maybe this, our society is in an anomaly that's big enough that makes this situation different from just your average typical situation in terms of, do you want to work or do you not want to work? What do you think about that?
Well, it's different, and nobody in America is at fault for this virus coming to into being, of course. But is it fundamentally different than flu or other types of coronaviruses or other types of common colds? We don't know yet. We don't know how many deaths there's going to be, and it's not even so easy to determine whether a death really is due to the coronavirus.
Correct.
Or whether someone dies of some sort of comorbidity while having been exposed to the coronavirus. So it's not going to be as simple as people think to tally up the deaths here. Okay. That said, I think markets and our medical profession can deal with the virus. We've certainly dealt with it before without shutting down society. I think that this is an overreaction and a bad one. And I think it points out, Bastiat's point of the seen and the unseen. It's very easy to tally up deaths. It's very easy to, calculate the medical costs of all these doctors and ICUs and ventilators and all that. But what's not so easy to calculate is the cost across society from a shutdown that does severe damage to our economy. There is some data around the 2008 crash. It's not very good. Social scientists are not very good at showing us the effects of trade-offs. In mm-hmm. other words, the unseen things that happen when we make certain political or economic decisions in this country. But for example, because of this shutdown, and God forbid it goes on much longer, there will be a lot more suicides. There will be a lot more obesity. There will be a lot more alcoholism. There will be a lot more spousal and child abuse. there will be a lot more depression. There will be a lot more mental health issues. There will be more obesity. There will be more alcoholism and drug abuse. There'll be all kinds of things that are very hard to calculate, either monetarily or otherwise, throughout the whole society. So, you know, the problem here is that we're thinking that this is a black or white trade-off. You know, save some lives now. That's far more important than money. Okay, but the comparison isn't just between saving lives and making money. That's not accurate. The comparison is between saving some lives now and potentially costing some in the future. But because one of those is easier to see and easier to calculate, we tend to give all of our attention to that. I think that's a mistake.
Jeff, let me just stop you just for a second, and I appreciate your opinion. What I want you to do, we're down here to, what do we got? We got about 3 minutes here, not even quite that, about 2.5 minutes. From an economic standpoint, from a strict monetary standpoint, what, in your opinion, should we be doing right now? 2.5, sorry.
I think we should be localizing this as much as possible. I think we should be quarantining people over 80. I think we should be putting warnings on people between 50 and 80, especially those with pre-existing conditions, to quarantine. And I think people under 50 should, unless they have some sort of serious health issues, should pretty much be allowed to go about their business. I think we could have very different rules for rural parts of the country as opposed to areas that have a large amount of cases like New York. So I think we could have the economy going on basically as normal in a place like Montana or Wyoming, whereas the economy in New York City might have to be severely constrained right now. So I don't think a top-down, one-size-fits-all approach works.
Of course not.
First and foremost, but that's what we get because we've all become so accustomed to and addicted to the federal government running everything and giving us the money when things go wrong.
I would agree. Got a minute here left. 1 minute exactly, 8 to 9 minutes, that particular segment. I believe this problem is solvable, and I think it's insolvable in part by what you just said. Why don't you wrap this up and say exactly, you got carte blanche, you can do whatever you want to save the economy.
Well, if I had to give out money, I would give it to individuals only. If we're going to have a big spending bill, make sure every penny of it goes to an individual, not a single government agency, not a single bank, not a single private company, not a single airline, not a single industry. Give it to individuals only, and then imagine, take all that money and everyone gets $13,000 or whatever it might be when you divide it up by the number of people in the country. And imagine someone like Boeing or Delta then putting out an ad in the paper and saying, everyone buy $1,000 of our stock. We need to raise cash, we're, you know, because of this downturn. And you'll all be a partial owner in Delta. And here's our prospects for future growth. Imagine just giving every penny of this bailout to individuals and none to the middlemen.
Okay, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Jeff is a bright guy. He's got some interesting ideas. If you have any questions for Jeff, utilize our blog. Be right back with Josh Fellow. Hey, welcome in, chatting with an old friend right now, Josh Philip. Josh, if I'm not mistaken, is the host of, and I know I'm not mistaken on this, he's a host of a TV program put out by the Epoch Times called Crossroads. He's also the senior investigative reporter for the Epoch Times. Haven't chatted with Josh for quite some time, so it'll be interesting to get a little bit caught up. Josh, how you been, bud?
I've been well here, semi-quarantined in New York, but enjoying the peace and quiet.
Is New York quiet and peaceful right now?
More so than I've probably ever seen it, yeah.
I'll bet it is. You know, we've got the same thing out here, although our population density is significantly less than yours. Hey, Josh, tell me a little bit more. You were on our show a while back, you had just started your TV series called Crossroads. I haven't talked to you since then because I didn't want to bug you because it appeared you were very, very busy back in those days. Tell us about Crossroads, would you?
Well, Crossroads came about through more of an observation, which is when you talk to people, you know, you go to political conferences or whatever, when you talk to people one-on-one,
right,
the conversations are very different from what you hear on the stages. When you go to, you know, go to the auditoriums, all you hear about are surface political talking points. But when you're talking one-on-one, it's values, it's philosophy, it's ideas. It's what people really believe in, the things that motivate the surface politics. And I thought it would be interesting because I don't think there was a platform really for it, at least not among, I'd say, bigger media,
yeah,
where people can come on and talk about what they really think. You know, they're kind of deeper ideas that influence the things we see on the surface. And so we came up with the name Crossroads as this kind of idea of the decisions we make that influence the course of our lives.
Strikes me that, I guess the first question I would have, I know it's a good show, I've seen it, it's on your website, and you've also got a channel on YouTube, if I'm not mistaken, but it strikes me that when you're talking to somebody face-to-face, and I personally can't explain the reason that this happens, but you're right, the conversation gets a lot more in-depth than when you're just, you know, interviewing somebody with a microphone or what have you, because they're always on guard then.
Yeah, well, that was kind of the idea, too. And I mean, you know, growing up, I don't think I ever knew which of my friends were conservative or, you know, liberal or whatever. It was, I mean, maybe you'd know with some people, but typically you didn't really care. I mean, to this day, I have friends across the political spectrum. I'd imagine most people have friends across the political spectrum. And when it comes to one-on-one, just hanging out, personal conversations, that tends to be fine.
Yeah.
Somehow, I think we lose our civility when it comes to this kind of groupthink surface politics. And, you know, we don't really give each other a chance to really talk about our values. We don't have a platform to talk about these things. We can't talk about belief, for example,
mm-hmm.
because there's so many different beliefs and people tend to get offended by it. You know, I just thought it'd be nice to have a platform where these things can be discussed in a way where we don't have to agree on everything, but that gives people, let's say, an environment where they're able to talk about these things. And so a lot of the interviews I'm more just facilitating, you know, just asking them questions. I don't really share too much of my own ideas. Maybe a little more lately, it's a more conversational. And then, of course, with this new CCP virus, we're calling it, this coronavirus.
Yep.
I've also been doing a lot of news updates and analysis because, of course, I've been investigating the Chinese Communist Party since 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And my area of expertise is very well fitted for some of the things happening right now.
Josh, I'm curious, have you come to any conclusions about maybe why this originated? Let's talk first, I bet you have on this one. Why did this thing originate in China, in your opinion?
Hard to say. I mean, if you want to talk about people, you know, possibly eating bats, that whole narrative really fell apart, basically.
Yeah.
And of course, the original narrative was it came from this Wuhan seafood market. That narrative was false. Basically, patient zero and among the 41 original cases they reviewed, patient zero had no connection whatsoever to that marketplace.
Mm.
Neither did a lot of the early cases. The Chinese Communist Party, for a little bit at least, individuals who were kind of running the show, made it so that having contact with that marketplace had to be a criteria of diagnosis. In other words, of course, they would make it seem like cases were coming from the market because you would not be diagnosed with the virus had you not had contact with it. And so there was a lot of manipulation behind it. Again, the whole thing fell apart when it got shown. I think it was different scientific journals did studies on it. But yeah, that whole narrative is false. If we want to talk about...
Yeah, let me ask you this. Yeah, I just want to get clear on one thing. When you talk about that market, are you talking about the market that is basically comprised of two different areas, one of them being where the virus kind of originated, and the second one being Milan, Italy? Are you talking about that market?
I'm not familiar with the Milan, Italy market. I'm talking about the market in Wuhan, seafood market, correct?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, though I understand that, sure. But if I'm not mistaken, one of the last flights that was canceled from China to outside of China was the flight to Milan. Apparently, there was a tremendous amount of commerce going on between the Chinese folks and the folks in northern Italy.
That is totally accurate, yes. Actually, there was a university in the UK that just did a big study of over 60,000 people who left Wuhan. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of people are aware, right before the Chinese Communist Party shut down, Wuhan, locked down travel, more than 5 million people left the city. Of course, this whole outbreak happened at the worst possible time.
You bet.
Which was right ahead of the Chinese New Year, where you have about 3 billion travel arrangements.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, it took place in Wuhan, which is the transit hub of all of China. And so this was the worst place, worst time it could have ever possibly happened. And yeah, this UK university, I did research on 60,000 individuals and traced kind of where they went. And the chart they put together shows almost like to the T areas where we had outbreaks afterwards.
Yeah.
Including Italy. And Italy has huge connections to the Chinese Communist Party, and they're very much suffering for that now.
Well, there's no question about that. I'll tell you, I've never been to Italy. I've been to Europe, obviously speaking, but I've never spent any time in Italy. And as much as I'd like to go there, given the opportunity, if I was given the opportunity right now, that is not at all a good place to be, in my opinion. Josh, what are you working on now? Are you pretty much focused on the virus?
Well, focused on the show Crossroads, and I've been doing 5-day-a-week broadcasts, giving news updates from some of our sources at Epoch Times into China, and also some of our reporters making phone calls into China, going over what we've been finding, doing analysis on the situation. That's been the focus lately. I'm also wrapping up a documentary I've been helping with, where we've investigated the origins of the virus, and in China specifically, of course. And that's going to be pretty interesting when it comes out.
Well, I certainly would plan on visiting that. Maybe you and I can chat about it. Josh, we got about a minute left here, and then I got to take a break for a commercial. What is the easiest way for listeners to tune in to Crossroads?
Go on YouTube, type in Crossroads with Joshua Phillip, JOSHUAPHILIPP.
You know what, I'll do better than that. I mean, obviously, thank you for saying that, but I will put that up on our website and make sure that we can hopefully get you some traffic there. I know you're going to get at least one, and that would be me. Josh, I want to keep in touch as your documentary unfolds. Maybe we can chat a little bit about how that's going and the direction that it seems to be taking. How does that sound?
Man, looking forward to it.
No, that would be great for sure. Listen, say hello, please, to all of my friends at the Epoch Times. I haven't talked to many people back there recently other than yourself. Say hi to Charlotte. Say hi to Valentine and the rest of them. Josh, it's a real pleasure catching up. Thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure also. Thanks.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.